Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Bright and bushy-tailed. I was just thinking of just half an hour ago, I was saying to the housekeeper that I had a podcast to do, and did she think I needed to shave? Well, I sort of kind of ventured the idea that I didn't need to shave. I thought I'd probably get away with it. And she looked at me with what I realized was undisguised skepticism and said, no, I think you can shave. So I am contrite, but clean shaven.
If you'd shown her a picture of the other people on the podcast, she may have said, actually, no, you can probably get away with not shaving. We also, of course, are joined by Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
Recovering from some flu. The normal seasonal type, but that kind of lingers. Otherwise, just shaking my head as usual.
Indeed. And there are many things to shake our head at today in our fair, fine, and fabulous country, as much as it sometimes gives us heartaches.
New alliteration school, you.
Yes. So let's start off with our first story. And I mean, I know it's been a favorite of the people who watch the show live, who comment about how upset people are about South Africa's 50 million rand gift, or as the government put it, a humanitarian aid to Cuba to help out the Cuban government because it's been going through some serious economic problems recently. Well, that was taken to court by AfriForum, which managed to get, I think, a high court interdiction to stop it, and that's now still going through legal battles. However, it has emerged in some documents that came out from that court case that there was a series of loans which were given to Cuba equaling 140 million rand between 2018 and now. So according to information that came out from the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, this was kind of released as part of the court case. It was found that this loan had been requested by the Cuban government. They had written to Naledi Pandor, the minister, and said Cuba was the victim of a plan designed by the United States government to collapse Cuba and provoke a social outbreak and justify external interventions. They were accusing the U.S. of preparing to invade Cuba. They basically went on to say this is why they needed the 50 million rand, but it also emerged from this that Jacob Zuma had, in 2012, signed a deal which was worth 350 million rands worth of economic assistance to Cuba. And then there was this large loan that was given in two chunks, one of 63 million rand in 2018 and the second chunk of 84 million rand in December of 2021, meaning that Cuba has been given 200 million rand by the South African government in the last 4 years, which is quite a staggering amount. Maybe not super huge in terms of the overall national budget, but I like to think that we maybe could have made better use of that. So, Terence, let me start with you. Why is government doing this? Is there a good reason to do it? What are your thoughts?
I think if you step through the looking glass and look at the ANC's own motivations and what drives its own sense of the necessary, it makes eminent sense. Our foreign policy is hugely ideological. In fact, the only real sort of a consistent theme within our foreign policy is this idea of South Africa being a country of the global South and facing off imperialism. It's very, every day is the 1960s. We're not wearing bell bottoms. You could probably buy some great new suits with that 147 million or whatever. Now, the ANC has had a sort of Cuba fixation that is long-standing, in part because they received some very real assistance from Cuba back in the old struggle days. I think more so because by proxy they feel a sense of gratitude for Cuba's role in Angola. So interestingly, the ANC was never really engaged in combat with the SADF in Angola. The Quito Kwanevale thing, that was SWAPO, that was the MPLA, that was the Cubans. The ANC was nowhere to be found, which is one reason why we never have an ANC veteran coming and talking about it. But yeah, you know, it's symbolic, it's ideological. The problem, of course, is that Cuba has nothing that South Africa really needs. There are no real commercial opportunities there. You want this as kind of one of the shining stars of your diplomatic universe, but you want to extend some sort of assistance, but you can't do it on any grounds that make any rational sense. So in the end, you end up doing things like the medical program. The medical program, at least you can say you get doctors, but you know, you have this crazy idea where you have Cuban technicians servicing South African vehicles. This is by the same government that goes on about localization, except when it comes to servicing the army's own trucks. It's a way you can buy something at a massively inflated price as a means of dispensing aid. South Africa, although many South Africans don't realize, is actually a fairly significant aid dispenser, mostly in Southern Africa. You know, the Southern African Customs Union, for instance. Much of the customs collected here goes as a compensation to Botswana, Namibia, Swaziland, Swatini, and Lesotho. I mean, more than half of the budgets of some of those countries. There's also quite a bit of aid spending in other parts of Africa, but Cuba is the sort of standout example. And in order to make this payment to a country that in very real terms doesn't make much difference to South Africa except in people's heads, you know, you end up doing things like taking the African Renaissance Fund and then, you know, changing the terms so that you call it developing countries, not African countries, etc. Does it make sense? Well, no, not in any sort of rational sense, no. But but it makes ideological sense if you're the ANC.
I would venture that Cuba's economic problems are less to do with America's blockade, which has been in effect, although it did have a break, I think, during the Obama administration since the 60s.
May I just say something there?
I'm
a bit of a language geek. There is no blockade of Cuba.
There's no ships sitting around it.
In the early 1960s, Cuba has, to all intents and purposes, been able to trade with every country in the world other than the United States. And a lot of American companies actually traded with Cuba anyway by setting up subsidiaries in Canada or Mexico. So, you know, an island sitting off the coast of a hostile superpower doesn't necessarily mean that the island in question is going to be an economic possible case. Taiwan, of course, has done very well.
Right. And this is my point, is that there's been far more to do, I think, the causes of Cuba's maladies are far more to do with their own mismanagement of the economy rather than the nefarious plots of the United States. But there's another sort of aspect to this. So, Michael, I just want your thoughts in general on this. But also, the DA says that it wants an audit of the $147 million because they believe that there's a possibility that someone was using this as a means to launder money around, because of corrupt enterprises or criminal enterprises, or maybe back into the ANC or something like that. Michael, what do you make of that? Do you think that's possible? And what do you think of this issue in general?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose tragically, one has to say it's entirely plausible, you know, and certainly worth investigating. The more attention we can get brought to bear on deals like this and this kind of spending, the better, I'm sure. I mean, it's a tragic reflection of what we've become used to, is that nothing really surprises anymore, you know. It's quite distressing. One thought is, one hopes that Cuba is, looking at a kind of crisis plan in the next 10 years or so to prepare for the possibility that, almost certainty that the ANC is not going to be around forever. Who are its other pals in the world? Terence, you probably know the answer to that. Just one last thought. I, I wouldn't mind getting Cuban music and Cuban ballet dancers over here. I think that that'd be a great investment in our lives. But aside from that.
Yeah, no, it's a tourist destination. If we had more money and Cuba was closer, maybe we really could have some economic ties there. But unfortunately, Mauritius is much closer and we don't have a lot of money. I really don't think there's much to be gained there. I think as for Cuba's friends, it's mostly sort of members of the old communist club. I think Russia is sort of friendly with it, but it's not super interested in helping them out. I know Venezuela has good relations, but they clearly don't have any money right now. I don't know, Terrence, who we're missing.
Cuba, you know, if you're living in a sensible country, Cuba is just another country with, you know, like archaic authoritarian political structures. Cuba has had actually quite cordial relations with Canada for decades. It has representation in most Western countries. There are, for instance, lots of European investments in hotels and the tourism industry. But look, its problem essentially is that it doesn't produce a great deal that is export worthy. In fact, in South Africa during the lockdown, the two biggest imports we got from Cuba, which were spirits and tobacco, all of a sudden became contraband. So, the person who started off that Cuban medical program is the same one that torpedoed the exports for us. But they've exported sort of medical expertise, security training, that sort of thing. A lot of those Cuban doctors go to places that are fairly wealthy. I think they've sent some to Qatar, to UAE. They paid for it in hard currency. I mean, this was something that Fidel Castro recognized in the 1970s, that there were developing countries which had a lot of cash, petrodollars particularly, but they couldn't get doctors on any terms. So the Cuban government could sort of, hand over a bunch of doctors and you get hard currency. In Venezuela, they were also their military and security advisors were also being paid. And I've heard stories, although I'm not sure about this, that the Angolan government also paid a fair whack of money for the Cuban internationals. In fact, so it was one of the ironies of the Cold War that you had Cuban soldiers defending American-owned refineries being paid effectively. And one Cuban defector said, unless the definition of the Spanish word has been changed, this means mercenary.
Right.
And I think, essentially what Cuba does in that sense is not that different from what the Swiss used to do in the Renaissance. You hire out your pikemen to go and, fight for the King of France or whatever. It worked for the Cubans, but they could disguise it with a cloak of ideology.
No, that is, I think, an underappreciated aspect actually of the relationships between Cuba and African countries. But so obviously we shouldn't be sending money to prop up a dysfunctional dictatorship on the other side of the world that doesn't really give us anything anyway. But what are you going to do? So we'll have to. I'm sure we'll hear more about this story once the court cases draw to a close. But something that everyone should be aware of how government is spending the money that we really don't have. Okay, let's move on to our next story. This is a story that's big on particularly on social media right now, but also on the on some of the big news sites. And it's another one of these ugly interactions between two people. I know the quintessential example of this is two people fighting in a spur. Well, this is between a white and a black student at Stellenbosch University. So the story goes something like this. A student is sleeping in his res at Stellenbosch University, a black student. He hears a strange noise. He thinks maybe it's his roommate coming back, even though his roommate's not supposed to be there. And he switches on the light, holding a glass vase in his hand, to find his roommate's friend, who he doesn't know that well, he's just had a little bit of small talk with him before, standing there peeing on his desk. He apparently has the thought of hitting the guy on the head with the vase, but another student comes in and says, dude, no, just record him because you're going to need this later to prove that he's messing up your stuff. So he records him, and this video has become publicly available. It's very short. It's only 24 seconds long. He asks him, bruh, why are you peeing in my room? And the guy mumbles something, sounds like he's drunk. He says, I'm waiting for someone. And then he asks him again, bruh, why are you peeing in my room? Then the guy sort of shouts, boy. And then he kind of looks sort of confused. And then he goes back to peeing, finishes. And then the video cuts. Just as the guy is taking the video, the black student is taking the video, is asking him again, what is he doing there? Why is he in his room? This apparently was taken, according to the victim. He said that he took this to the res committees, and they didn't really take it too seriously. They just thought it was not really a big deal. It then circulated around campus. It got picked up by SASCO, and I'm not sure whether this was in the original allegations or came later. It's been a little bit unclear to me from the news reading, and maybe this is my lack of literacy on this, but apparently the white guy who peed in his room said, this is what we do to black boys. Now, I don't know if that happened. It's not in the in the video, but it, clearly that's pretty bad if he did say that. Anyway, there's now been a big furor about this. Everyone is very upset. The guy whose stuff was peed on, his parents have demanded that he lay criminal charges, although he's not really been keen on doing it. In fact, his father said, if he doesn't lay criminal charges, I will. There's been a lot of people saying that this is representative of a culture of exclusion and racism at Stellenbosch University, and that this is all part of, you know, treating some people like they don't belong to the university community. The student himself has said that he thinks that there are some problems at the university. The guy's stuff was peed on. He says that he thinks that people are not engaging or talking properly to each other, and that there are things that need to be changed in the university, but that he's really just, the impression I get from the communication with him, the interviews with him, is that he really just kind of wants to get back to his studies and just put this all behind him, because he's rather upset by the whole thing. The student who did the peeing apparently apologized to the res at large. And so it's provoked a bit of a debate, actually between us and Michael. I want to get your thoughts on this, but for me, this seems like one of those stories that should have been taken seriously by the disciplinary committee of whatever the res or the university, whatever. They should have made the guy apologize, pay for the stuff to be broken, clean the guy's room, and that probably should have been the end of it. But a lot of people have taken this to be some example of a larger problem. Michael, your thoughts?
You say we spoke a bit about it beforehand, and in my view, it really is tends to the latter, that there is something larger here. I mean, I agree that there's an incident that can be dealt with and needs to be dealt with that perhaps could have been dealt with without anyone else knowing about it. I don't think if we hadn't known about it, it wouldn't have made the greater context of incidents like that any less. We just wouldn't have been subject to any kind of debate. So I certainly think it's a kind of incident that's quite tricky, easily kind of lends itself to being exploited by all kinds of people one way or the other. It's a kind of thing where people tend to have very strong views. It's either a simple matter that has nothing whatever to do with society, just between two people. Or on the other hand, the other extreme, this is a symptomatic of something bigger. And I can see both. And I think it was a particular incident, but I don't think it can be separated from a larger picture, which I do think probably is a more serious problem in our society than many people will accept. And I think other societies are quite similar in this regard. I mean, I think Israel perhaps is a very good example, and the Holocaust experience is perhaps analogous. It's certainly not comparable, but I think there's some kind of analogy there. And that is that the way people experience their day-to-day lives cannot be separated from their history, their memories, and how they think. This is all part of the thing. And for me, this is kind of brought into sharper focus by in a video that some people may have seen of protesting students, and there's one student who asks a question as to whether the same process would have been followed had a black student done this, and this question earned immediate applause, which I think demonstrated where most of the protesting students certainly how they felt about this. And I'm not necessarily sure that they're right, but I am sure that the incident would not have played out remotely in the way that it did had the alleged perpetrator been black and the victim been white. And I think the reason for that is because we all bring to our actions and our assumptions about acting the certainties and the doubts that are part of our lives, our history, our memories, and so on. And that to me is a tricky thing in South Africa, because if we simply content ourselves with saying this is an isolated incident, it's just this one man's experience, all it takes is an apology, the other student was drunk, and we leave it at that, what we're actually excluding is that student's truer sensation of what has happened there. I can't speak for him. I can only imagine. One can only try and empathize here. It's disempowering. Perhaps he feels that he doesn't have a voice. He doesn't have a right to say what he really thinks. Something that we've often argued as the IRR is that, you know, feelings and facts are two different things. Don't confuse them. But I've in fact written about, a piece of writing about visiting Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the Holocaust Museum, where I said something and triggered an engagement where I realized that I was talking about facts, and the person I was talking to, who happened to have an elderly woman who happened to have a tattoo on her arm, was talking about feelings. And it just brought home to me the very real presence of our histories in our lives, that we can discount it and say it's irrational. I don't think it is. I think we do need to confront it. So there's a rather long way of dealing with it, but I think it is important. There's a risk of making of it something that it isn't, a racist crisis and all the rest of it. I'm not sure that that's the way to go, but that there is something here which we need to talk about.
Terence, your thoughts?
I don't think I can better what Michael has wisely said. I would just like to read comment by Whiskey Jack ZA. It should be unacceptable to pee on a fellow Kosse's brother's stuff and use racist language. When I saw this, you know, it's just like my brain started to boil. This is not rocket science. One does not go into another person's room and urinate. You know, ancient Rome was considered, you know, a highly civilized society because they had toilet facilities. You know, I think that you know what I would perhaps just add to Michael is that we do get there is always a danger of this being exploited, people bringing to bear their own sense of what must have happened. And I think the question of racist language is, as you said, it's not in any video recording that I've seen. Is this something that's perhaps being bolted on after the fact? The guy in that video seemed too out of it to get any kind of coherence together. Maybe he's the biggest racist in the world. I've got no idea. But for me, maybe what we're seeing here is part of South Africa's unhealthy relationship with alcohol. The romanticization of bad behavior. Yeah, you know, I was also a student. I also remember this sort of thing. I remember someone coming and spitting yogurt all over my door one morning. It was like, why? It's just like, why? You know, manners and consideration, even when one is being ridden by Bacchus, they don't go awry. you know, it's heartbreaking. Communal living is also difficult, you know, to do with people you don't really know who come from different backgrounds.
Right, especially when everyone is a young guy is drinking a lot.
You know, I remember one weekend shortly before my midterm exams, I had a person lived across the hall. He had got this stereo system, which he had cranked up full bore, and just left it playing all weekend while he went away. You know, literally kept everyone away.
Madness. Dreadful. You know, what are my thoughts on this one? I think there's two. I think you were right, Terrence, to kind of separate out these two accusations. So there's the video evidence, which is pretty conclusive. The guy definitely went in and
absolutely
and peed on this guy's stuff.
He deserves to be.
Yeah, in big trouble for that. His laptop, his exam notes, you know, it's pretty bad.
No, absolutely disgusting.
But then there's the second accusation, which is not on film. And like I said, I think the first time I saw it was in the Sasco statement, which is that he allegedly framed this in a racial way, saying, we do this to you because you're black. And that's a far more serious allegation, which should be treated far more seriously. Yeah. But to my mind, it's not proven yet. So if the second allegation turns out to be true, it's that he did say something like that, maybe there's like a witness or something like that who can back up the story, or maybe, you know, it's in another recording, then he should face more severe consequences for that as well, because you can't, you know, you're supposed to live together in a res, you're supposed to be, you know, on a non-racial campus, and you cannot treat other human beings like that. It's just outrageous. But if that accusation is not true, then I am a bit uncomfortable by what you're saying there, Michael, because I do see that, you know, we live in a country where we do have incidents like this where two people fight in a Spur, two people fight in a shopping, you know, in a Checkers line or whatever, and people jump up. And you did say that people do misuse it, but people do kind of immediately try to turn it into this is representative of the entire nature of race relations in this country. And I don't think that that's true. And I think for me, what's really concerning about this is the victim made the allegation that the res, when he showed them the video of this, didn't take any sort of disciplinary action at first until it became a big media story. And to me, that's really the point of failure here, is that the university administration, if indeed that accusation is true, should have done something about this. They should have stepped up and said, look, this is unacceptable conduct. You have to pay this guy back. You have to apologize to him. We have to clean the room, and we're going to look into these alleged racist remarks. But anyway, Michael, final thoughts to you.
I mean, I think that last point could be exactly a reflection of what I'm talking about. Is, you know, it wasn't really taken all that seriously because, you know, this is what students do, and the guy was drunk, and, you know, kind of suck it up. But for some people, I can see that for some people in society who are not like me, I mean, I accept that I'm very privileged. I feel confident enough to speak with authority, to occupy a space. But a lot of people don't. And they would read that as symptomatic of how they understand their own lives, the lives of their parents, their memories, their history, and so on. And I think my argument is, you know, it's not, I don't think it's helpful. I don't agree with the sort of terminology of systemic racism or the patriarchy, or I forget what the other thing is. You always hear power relations, all this sort of stuff. What we're talking about is actually just human lives. You know, it's how we live, it's how we think, and it's how we experience things. And I think a lot of it is not so much racism as racialism. And I think there is a difference between the two of them. But racialism is also very, very harmful. We see it in BEE, but we also see it in just these ordinary things where kind of assumptions are made about what people are with or what their standing is in society. A lot of us perhaps are not even aware of how these gradations work, but they're at work, I think, all the time. And I don't think it's a bad thing to talk about them. And by the same token, I think, you know, a punitive response to one particular incident is actually not the issue. That's not really going to become near to addressing why there are thousands of students, or maybe not thousands, hundreds of students protesting. They're protesting for a reason, and I don't think it's just to be opstrukers and to be difficult. You know, I think a lot of people have a sense of some kind of grievance, and maybe they can't express it. It's difficult to capture. People aren't taking you seriously. It makes you angrier, and so on. So I do think there's a thing there. And I know that the IRR, you know, kind of tends to argue in the opposite direction, but I think part of liberalism is also providing the space for an argument which might be a little bit discomforting.
You know, I would just like to make one comment there, and I agree with Michael. Perception is often its own reality. It may, however, be a distorted perception of reality, and I think that the only way you can get by this is by a sort of piece of the brave being actually willing to do what we like to express in sort of cookie cutter slogans about have the uncomfortable conversations, but you know, don't sort of, well, we start to have an uncomfortable conversation and then I'll shut it down because it's making me uncomfortable, or you know, I don't have to tolerate white tears, etc., etc., etc. I think communicating across uncomfortable boundaries will, by definition, produce discomfort. And you know, I think that's something that everyone, and perhaps not always in equal measure, and perhaps unfairly so, has to be willing to shoulder. Unless this is all essentially narcissistic and saying, well, you know, I'm speaking my truth, and I don't care, you know, and I have no regard for anything else.
Indeed. Well, we are out of time. I didn't expect this discussion to go so long. But anyway, I thought it was interesting, and I hope that our audience believes the same. Anyway, we will be back tomorrow. I'd just also like to let everyone know that there won't be a show on Thursday because we are doing some other work activities which will happen at the same time as the show. So we won't be around on Thursday, but there will be a show tomorrow. But I'll remind you guys then. Anyway, I'll see you guys all soon, and I hope you have a most excellent and wonderful day. Cheers.